David, a poem by Earl Burney. David and I that summer cut trails on the survey, all week in the valley for wages, in air that was steeped in the wail of mosquitoes. But over the sun-alive weekends, we climbed to get from the ruck of the camp, the surly poker, the wrangling, the snoring under the fetid tents. And because we had joy in our lengthening coltish muscles, and mountains for David were made to see over, stairs from the valleys and steps to the sun's retreats. Our first was Mount Gleam. We hiked in the long afternoon to a curling lake and lost the lure of the faceted cone in the swell of its sprawling shoulders. Past the inlet, we grilled our bacon, the strips festooned on a poplar prong, in the hurrying slant of the sunset. Then the two of us rolled in the blanket, while round us the cold pines thrust at the stars. The dawn was a floating of mists till we reached to the slopes above timber and won to snow like fire in the sunlight. The peak was upthrust like a fist in a frozen ocean of rock that swirled into valleys the moon could be rolled in. Remotely unfurling eastward, the alien prairie glittered. Down through the dusty scree on the west, we descended, and David showed me how to use the give of shale for giant, incredible strides. I remember before the larch's edge that I jumped a long green surf of juniper flowing away from the wind and landed in gentian and saxifrage spilled on the moss. Then the darkening firs, and the sudden whirring of water that knifed down a fern-hidden cliff and splashed unseen into mist in the shadows. One Sunday on Ramparts Arete, a rain squall caught us and passed, and we clung by our bluing fingers and boot nails an endless hour in the sun, not daring to move till the ice had steamed from the slate. And David taught me how time on a knife edge can pass with the guessing of fragments remembered from poets, the naming of strata beside one, and matching of stories from school days. We crawled astride the peak to feast on the marching ranges flagged by the fading shreds of the shattered storm cloud. Lingering there, it was David who spied to the south, remote and unmapped, a sunlit spire on Sawback, an overhang crooked like a talon. David named it the Finger. That day we chanced on the skull and the splayed white ribs of a mountain goat underneath a cliff face caught on a rock. Around were the silken feathers of hawks, and that was the first I knew that a goat could slip. And then Inglesmaldy. Now I remember only the long ascent of the lonely valley, the live pine spirally scarred by lightning, the slicing pipe of invisible pika, and great prints by the lowest snow of a grizzly. There it was, too, that David taught me to read the scroll of coral in limestone and the beetle seal in the shale of ghostly trilobites, letters delivered to man from the Cambrian waves. On Sundance, we tried from the call, and the going was hard. The air howled from our feet to the smudged rocks and the papery lake below. At an outthrust, we balked, till David clung with his left to a dint in the scarp, lobbed the ice axe over the rocky lip, slipped from his holds, and hung by the quivering pick, twisted his long legs up into space, and kicked to the crest. Then, grinning, he reached with his freckled wrist and drew me up after. We set a new time for that climb. That day, returning, we found a robin gyrating in grass, wing broken. I caught it to tame, but David took and killed it and said, "Could you teach it to fly?" In August, the second attempt, We ascended the fortress. By the forks of the Spray, we caught 5 trout and fried them over a balsam fire. The woods were alive with the vaulting of mule deer and drenched with clouds all the morning, till we burst at noon to the flashing and floating round of the peaks. Coming down, we picked in our hats the bright and sun-hot raspberries, eating them under a mighty spruce, while a marten, moving like quicksilver, scouted us. But always, we talked of the finger on sawback, unknown and hooked, till the first afternoon in September we slogged through the musky woods, past a swamp that quivered with frog song, and camped by a bottle-green lake. But under the cold breath of the glacier, sleep would not come, the moonlight etching the finger. We rose and trod past the feathery larch, while the stars went out, and the quiet heather flushed, and the skyline pulsed with a surging bloom of incredible dawn in the Rockies. David spotted bighorns across the moraine and sent them leaping. With yodels, the ramparts redoubled and rolled to the peaks and the peaks to the sun. The ice in the morning thaw was a gurgling world of crystal and cold blue chasms and seracs that shone like frozen salt green waves. At the base of the finger, we tried once and failed. Then David edged to the west and discovered the chimney. The last 100 feet we fought the rock and shouldered and kneed our way for an hour and made it. Unroping, we formed a cairn on the rotting tip. Then I turned to look north at the glistening wedge of giant Assiniboine, heedless of handhold. And 1 foot gave. I swayed and shouted. David turned sharp and reached out his arm and steadied me, turning again with a grin and his lips ready to jest. But the strain crumbled his foothold. Without a gasp, he was gone. I froze to the sound of grating edge nails and fingers, the slither of stones, the lone second of silence, the nightmare thud. Then only the wind and the muted beat of unknowing cascades. Somehow, I worked down the 50 impossible feet to the ledge, calling and getting no answer but echoes released in the cirque, and trying not to reflect what an answer would mean. He lay still, with his lean young face upturned and strangely unmarred, but his legs splayed beneath him beside the final drop, 600 feet sheer to the ice. My throat stopped when I reached him, for he was alive. He opened his gray, straight eyes and brokenly murmured, "Over! Over!" And I, feeling beneath him a cruel fang of the ledge thrust in his back, but not understanding, mumbled stupidly, "Best not to move," and spoke of his pain. But he said, "I can't move. If only I felt some pain." Then my shame stung the tears to my eyes as I crouched, and I cursed myself. But he cried, louder, "No, Bobby, don't ever blame yourself. I didn't test my foothold." He shut the lids of his eyes to the stare of the sky, while I moistened his lips from our water flask, and tearing my shirt into strips, I swabbed the shredded hands. But the blood slid from his side and stained the stone and the thirsting lichens, and yet I dared not lift him up from the gore of the rock. Then he whispered, "Bob, I want to go over." This time I knew what he meant, and I grasped for a lie and said, "I'll be back here by midnight with ropes and men from the camp, and we'll cradle you out." But I knew that the day and the night must pass, and the cold dews of another morning before such men, unknowing the ways of mountains, could win to the chimney's top. And then how long? And he knew. And the hell of hours after that, if he lived till we came, roping him out. But I curled beside him and whispered, "The bleeding will stop. You can last." He said only, "Perhaps. For what? A wheelchair, Bob?" His eyes, brightening with fever, upbraided me. I could not look at him more and said, "Then I'll stay with you." But he did not speak for the clouding fever. I lay dazed and stared at the long valley, the glistening hair of a creek on the rug stretched by the firs, while the sun leaned round and flooded the ledge, the moss, and David still as a broken doll. I hunched to my knees to leave, but he called, and his voice now was sharpened with fear. "For Christ's sake, push me over, if I can move or die." The sweat ran from his forehead, but only his eyes moved. A hawk was buoying blackly its wings over the wrinkled ice. The purr of a waterfall rose and sank with the wind. Above us climbed the last joint of the finger, beckoning bleakly the wide, indifferent sky. Even then in the sun, it grew cold lying there, and I knew he had tested his holds. It was I who had not. I looked at the blood on the ledge and the far valley. I looked at last in his eyes. He breathed, "I'd do it for you, Bob." I will not remember how or why I could twist up the wind-deviled peak and down through the chimney's empty horror and over the traverse alone. I remember only the pounding fear I would stumble on it when I came to the grave-cold maw of the Berkshrend, reeling over the sun-cankered snow bridge, shying the caves and the neve, the fear and the need to make sure it was there on the ice. The running and falling and running, leaping of gaping green-throated crevasses, alone and pursued by the finger's lengthening shadow. At last, through the fanged and blinding Syrinx, I slid to the milky wrangling falls at the glacier snout, through the rocks piled huge on the humped moraine, and into the spectral larches alone. By the grooming lake, I sank and chilled my mouth, but I could not rest, and stumbled still to the valley, losing my way in the ragged marsh. I was glad of the mire that covered the stains on my ripped boots, of his blood, but panic was on me. The reek of the bog, the purple glimmer of toadstools obscene in the twilight. I staggered clear to a fire waste, tripped and fell with a shriek on my shoulder. It somehow eased my heart to know I was hurt. But I did not faint, and I could not stop while over me hung the range of the sawback. In blackness, I searched for the trail by the creek and found it. My feet squelched a slug, and horror rose again in my nostrils. I hurled myself down the path. In the woods behind, some animal yelped. Then I saw the glimmer of tents and babbled my story. I said that he fell straight to the ice where they found him. And none but the sun and incurious clouds have lingered around the marks of that day, on the ledge of the finger, that day, the last of my youth, on the last of our mountains.
This poem is recorded by permission of the estate of Earl Burney.